Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 24th of October 2018. I'm taking my constitutional. And today I'm going to go off at a tangent and put current affairs and economics and politics on one side and provide a commentary on a small part of a book that I produced maybe 10 years ago. Which actually was a slim volume of poems, well, sort of poems, which were specifically for the people who had asked me to help them to become yoga teachers. So this was their training manual, but rather than producing some dense text and some photographs of yoga postures and some technical explanations of this, that and the other, pranayama, meditation, mudra, bandha, blah blah, the whole caboodle, I kind of went along the tack of providing some didactic poems with quite a high degree of condensation of meaning into just a few short lines or even just a few words. And at the time, that seemed like the way to go. Well, just popped out the woods onto the towpath as an aside, and there's a heron just a few yards away, totally motionless, standing on the bank. His neck is as long as his body. And he's completely still and vertical, just looking straight forward. It's kind of amazing. Anyway, they're big beasts, those are, you know, for this country, anyway. Anyway, where was we? So, I'm a bit reluctant to do this. I'm a bit kind of shy about it, to be honest with you, for God knows what reason. And but somebody did ask and said, can you provide a commentary on these verses? So I'm going to pick a few over the next few months, probably at random, not necessarily in order. And just provide a bit of a commentary and expand on the metaphors and the condensed meaning. Now, just a few prior comments. Didactic poems. Well, that's problematic right to start with. And poetry shouldn't be didactic. But nevertheless, this was an attempt to pass over some information or to provide some productive irritation to people who'd asked me specifically to teach them to, in their own turn, to become teachers. I mean, this is a weird paradoxical thing just to start with, you know, and a quixotic thing. But nevertheless, I went for it. It was a nice challenge. And I wrote these things pretty well, like one a day. Usually I would wake up with the verse more or less preformed. Subsequent to that, over the years, I've added the odd one or two. And I think actually the more recent ones are better, but you kind of think that anyway. I did publish a few, self-publish a few copies of this and have distributed them over the years. At the moment, I don't have any. I think I'm going to revise, and I'm going to add a few. I've got some things on the anvil that I'm going to add to it, and put it out again, probably in a printed limited edition with a nice cover and so forth. Anyway, that's what Anna's pressing me to do, so I think I'm going to do it. Now, there's another heron just landed on a branch, a very thin branch actually, just over the water there. And he's doing the same thing of being perfectly still. It's very beautiful, that stillness that they have and the watchfulness. He's probably going to fly off when I go right underneath him. Yeah, he's off. There we go. Anyway, So that's the background. the production of the book. Oh, the title is Songs of No and Yes. And this is precisely, I think this is a very precise title, at least for me. As much precision as I can muster. And it does refer to a movement of denial and an affirmation that I discern in yoga practice, having been engaged in that for over 50 years. Now the no part, I put no before yes there, you know, songs of no and yes. The no part is the deep denial of received wisdom that one might be tempted to live inside. The story that we might be tempted to wrap ourselves around so that we don't have to encounter the rawness of dancing under the open sky. And it seems to me that Patanjali's first skirmish with the whole notion of yoga is to say that yoga is the end of the mind. No, well, it's the negation of the power of repeated patterns of mentation, thought, feeling, and behaviour that lives in our minds, in our mind stuff, in the substance of our minds, and generally causes us to suffer and to be conflicted within ourselves. And the recommendation would be better off without that kind of repetitive, neurotic circling. In the old days, and I was a bit more nihilistic than I am now, I would translate that second verse of the Yoga Sutra as Patanjali telling us that everything you believe is shit, or everything you believe is wrong. So there's a kind of, the no part is a kind of an ecstatic nihilism. We find it in the world's spiritual traditions. It tends to get downplayed because it is like a very sharp razor. It can be hard to take. Some people on encountering it can freak out. But I would say that when the Buddha said, the Buddha has no opinions, was, utilising that same deep negation. And Lao Tzu's insistence on the ineffability of the ineffable. He who speaks does not know. That basically is everything you think is shit. It's a bit unforgiving, and that's why we've got yes as well. That's where we try and affirm something and not fall prey to the constant abrasion of negation, negation, negation. Neti, 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 you might say as well. Also in the Upanishads, of course, we have this push into the ineffable. Now, I'm somebody who wants to say that words and language and discourse and thought are essential parts of human life. But, however, we need to realise that they are wrapped around in and penetrated by and included in the great ocean of ineffability, the great ocean of ecstasy, and that we need that too. And also to insist that this is not a binary, you know, that we don't have the yoga being state and then our kind of crap thinking as opposites, it's one or the other. I want to affirm that the yoga being state can include everything, including our nonsense. So there is a softening to that no part, and that's why I kind of introduced the yes part. I have to say, there is more no than yes. I always, in those days, found myself a student saying, no, I don't think that's quite right. Because I was being asked to confirm people's fond beliefs. so that perhaps they'd feel a bit less insecure, even though my tendency, which I try not to inflict on people, but which they come to me to experience, is to not be very charitable towards our self-calming, right, including my own, obviously. The problem with all this is that, as I've perhaps just intimated, is that it comes across as kind of harsh, as kind of desperate, as kind of leaving us with nothing to grab onto, no support. But as I said, I also want to affirm that there is affirmation in the midst of this. Great affirmation, great ecstasy, great positivity. And life. Okay, so that's the background. I'm going to find a spot where I can sit for a moment and read the first song from Songs of Knowing Yes. Here it is, the first one. It's called Sitting. I sit in joy and sorrow, in pain and mirth. I can't find myself. I can't lose myself. Who am I? The question melted in a wave of fire. This smiling day, sweet breath, comes and goes, as rhythmic as the earth's wobble, and the wake and sleep of leaves. Whilst somewhere on this beautiful planet right now, someone is being tortured. The beauty and the horror and the beauty. Yes, yes, it's enough to make you give up on life. But please don't. Instead, loosen the belly's clench. Stand down the guard on your ramparts. Let this sweetness free you from the need to torture yourself or anybody else. So, there is a dialectical tension right at the heart of that poem or song. There is a yes and a no right there in the midst of it, right there in the midst of a description of the very simplest and most direct sitting meditation, which one just sits. Now, sitting, to my mind, is very potent and very wonderful. As Zen Master once said, when sitting, just sit. Above all, don't wobble. And then you will realise your Buddha nature. In that very act of the simplicity of sitting, Buddha nature is there. You are Buddha. Patanjali would agree. This is the whole second verse of Patanjali. Second aphorism is about that very easeful but very intense presence with oneself, with one's immediate experience and the flow of it. And as I describe it there, there's a sweetness to it, and it's a sweetness that pervades the universe and the processes of the universe, of the what did I describe it as, you know, as the rhythmic wobble of the earth. I'm talking about the precession of the equinoxes, that the earth, like a spinning top, wobbles on its axis, and that there's a rhythm to that, just as there's a rhythm to sitting. Sitting is very dynamic, and the rhythm being breath, heartbeat, and so forth. Certainly I light there upon that easeful in and out of the breath, the coming and going of the breath. But also I like natural processes. Leaves, I talked to, what did I call it? The wake and sleep of leaves. And here we are in the autumn and the leaves are now just curling up and going to sleep. In the spring they'll wake. The trees will send out buds and there'll be awakening of leaves. The whole archetype of leaf, the whole form of leaf has this rhythmic existence. The seasons have this rhythmic existence. So there's a real beauty in it and a cosmic universality that's present right there in the very simple dynamism and rhythm of sitting still, sitting quietly doing nothing. But yet, and here is the dialectic of yes and no of spiritual practice per se. The whole question of in retreating to our monasteries and our ashrams, are we escaping? Are we escaping from politics? Are we escaping from the suffering in the world? Just as there is this universality descends on us when we sit, when we realise our participation as little human animals in the great cosmic rhythms and the great dynamism of existence itself, there's also that world of men and women and politics and struggle and war and suffering and pain and flourishing sometimes and all the wonderful creative productions of human beings alongside the cruelty that goes down. I mean, just this week we've heard about some guy who was apparently tortured and dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The cruelty of it, the cruelty. And if there is going to be a real embrace of that universality in one's meditations, you're going to be aware of that cruelty. You might find it in yourself. You're going to be aware that somebody's been tortured. You, in some sense, the pain of all that sort of belongs to you. Obviously, it's not going to be as vivid for you as the guy who's got the thumb screws on. But nevertheless, there is this sort of participation. And this is very, very problematic. These quarrels have been going on as long as I can remember, you know, between people who think that the solution to the world's ills is in sorting themselves out. And John Lennon said it, you know, he said, free your mind instead. Don't try and change the world directly, because you're probably going to end up being motivated by hatred. Free your mind instead. And kind of think, well, it's all right for him. He was a millionaire. You know, I've got a lot of respect for John Lennon. He's a great rock and roll poet, you know, and a great rock and roll voice. But there's that kind of, there's something that grates a little bit, you know, with this, we're going to put everything right by sorting ourselves out. Now, I think that realisation, and only recently, I think it was yesterday, listening to some young Marxist commentator on the current political economic situation, which seems to me to be quite dire, and saying, you know, you're not going to sort it out by eating tofu. You know, and can you lifestyle merchants stop trying to guilt trip the working class because they don't eat tofu and buy cheap food and blah blah, you know. And there's a kind of a debate going on around that at the moment. But as I say, it's been going down for ages. People have been arguing about this as long as I can remember. And for me, this dialectic, which contains a real yes to the sweetness of sitting and the universality and the the wonder of it. On the one hand, and the deep suspicion on the other hand of any kind of spiritual discourse. Like the barking of that dog, which proclaims that it's going to save the world, just because we could become very introverted, very perhaps maybe self-obsessed, or even just concerned to see what's going down with us, if we use that lens of quietness and retreat to do some inquiring, to do some clear seeing of our own situation, of our who am I? You could almost say that there's a conflict between, or a dialectical tension between spirituality and politics, spiritual inquiry and political engagement. I actually don't think this is true. I think that some kind of attempt to figure out what political engagement is effectively going to be can emerge from a non-sectarian inquiring style of sitting, or just being quiet, walking meditation, being in nature, all these kind of things. Just that inquiry, that openness to what is to stand forth. And it comes to us as a kind of a realisation that even though we can't say very much about the ineffable, about that great inclusive ineffable that we will encounter eventually, sooner rather than later, I hope, if we're quiet. And even though we can't say very much about that, there is the one thing that we should perhaps stick our necks out and say, that layer, that ineluctable inclusivity, has got the quality of love. And if you've got any anti-empathic hardness in your soul, it will be dissolved as you sit by that realisation that somebody's being tortured. And I have to say, politically, I am committed to revolution and don't do much about it. I'm an old man, waiting for the Grim Reaper. All I can do is talk, and that's not very effective. However, I'm going to assert that there's a tension, but it's not a stark opposition, it's not an either or. And in this context, I'd point you to a little phrase that Simone de Beauvoir came up with in The Ethics of Ambiguity, which she wrote just after the end of the Second World War. I think it might have been 1946. This is a remarkable text, an existentialist text on ethics that's really much more readable than Sartre's Being and Nothingness, for instance. You can, with just a little bit of application, read it and get the sense of it. And Simone de Beauvoir talked about the yogi and the commissar. Of course, as existentialists, her and Sartre and Merleau-Ponty and the rest of them, and Camus, were interested in themselves. We're interested in the question of lived experience. But at the same time, they were Marxists. They'd been through the Second World War, which in Paris, in occupied Paris, which, if If anything's going to politicise you, it's that. And they were political animals as well. And Simone de Beauvoir got this idea, the yogi and the commissar. This is how we want to be as philosophers. We incorporate the qualities of the yogi and the commissar. The self-inquiry and politics. And a concern for the bit of the macrocosm, as well as a concern for the microcosm. And I'd put it to you, you know, that if you're a meditator or a spiritual person, inverted commas, that being concerned solely for one's self, one's progress, one's samadhi, whatever, that you're missing out half the picture, and you can't do that. This is what we do. It's an openness to everything. That sitting meditation is an openness to what is, whatever is. Even though a part of that what is humanity's cruelty. Now these days we hear a lot about acceptance, accept it, accept, breathe out, accept. And this is kind of right, you know, if you want the best life you can get in any circumstances, even if those circumstances are hard. But there's a real danger in this meme, that people take it to mean, well, just lie down in the snow and die. Russian fatalism, as Nietzsche called it. That this is an invitation to that kind of fatalism. You can't have fuck all about anything, so just, well, hedonism, maybe. But maybe just giving up, just accept. Acceptance is kind of giving up. And that really is a passive nihilism. It is kind of toxic. You know, it's a disease of despair, I would say. And people pushing this meme, I think, really very often, not always, but very often understand it in that way. Don't get engaged. This is the bit where you sit. You realise people are being tortured and you pull the shutters down on the idea. We're back there with the flowers and the clouds and the rainbows. And the glory of our rainbow body and the sweetness of our in and in breath and our out breath. But I say, the beauty and the horror and the beauty. And yes, acceptance. That is what sitting is. It's a radical openness to what is, whatever is. That in fact is what the enlightened state is, that's the yoga being state. Radical openness to what is, whatever is. And the method is letting be with bright awareness. Letting it be. So there is immense acceptance in what I'm proposing here. But we have to remember that we can also accept our own impulses to enhance life. To however we can be engaged in the whole question of human suffering and the suffering of others. And without being a bleeding heart, without letting the tragedy of it all dispirit us, nevertheless accepting and affirming that side of ourselves as well. In other words, you know, the yogi needs to accept, be open to his own inner commissar. And by the commissar I don't mean any kind of militaristic thing, but the person who really feels the urge and tries to do something about it to contribute to the mitigation of human suffering and human cruelty. And I think if you're a yoga teacher, you are kind of in that game, even if you say nothing about it. If you're inviting people into your room and you yourself are allowing yourself to become open to what is, radically open to what is, whatever it is, the people around you will be infected by that. They've come to you for it. They might not know exactly what it is, but they've come for that something. And they too will encounter this horror and beauty and beauty and horror. And you know, but it's a tricky impasse, I think, when that happens, because it's easy to misunderstand what acceptance and openness is. It's easy to misunderstand it in such a way that you think it means bracking it out, any political engagement, but it's a turning your back on the rough and tumble of the world and on the madness of the world. It's not. And that is what I was trying to put over in this poem. I think what I'm going to do is read it again, because it will have gone out of your mind by now, and call it a day when I've done so. Okay? It's called Sitting. I sit in joy and sorrow, in pain and mirth. I can't find myself. I can't lose myself. Who am I? The question melted in a wave of fire. This smiling day, sweet breath comes and goes, as rhythmic as the earth's wobble and the wake and sleep of leaves, whilst somewhere on this beautiful planet, right now, someone is being tortured. The beauty and the horror and the beauty. Yes, yes, it's enough to make you give up on life, but please don't. Instead, loosen the belly's clench. Stand down the guard on your ramparts. Let this sweetness free you from the need to torture yourself or anybody else. Thank you for listening. Speak soon. Over and out.